You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey everyone, From the Back Burner podcast is sponsored by Birch Barrel. You know, we as humans are connected by fire, and our time is in this world is better spent with food, fire, and friends. And whether you're cooking, camping, or developing relationships with each other, Birch Barrel is the perfect companion for your outdoor-centered lifestyle. Visit birchbarrel.com. Check out everything they've got. They've got everything from the Birch Barrel itself, V2, which is the one that I run. They've got a lot of different accessories like the Stockman gloves or the pan lifter, plowman's board, knives, seasoning, apparel, you name it. But if you're going to be there and you want to purchase anything, use my promo code Burner, B-U-R-N-E-R, at checkout for a 10% discount. Really appreciate those guys sponsoring this podcast. So today's episode, I've been super excited about this episode coming up as I've kind of worked through it and thought about it. And so today's episode is completely devoted to the subject of tacos. As we all know, I think arguably you could say, tacos are the largest rival here in America to hamburgers. Heck, there's even a day of the week devoted to tacos. Hamburgers don't even get that. They are a very simple meal in some cases, but also they have kind of an extraordinary story, that comes along with them. And so some of my listeners will actually remember back to what I lovingly refer to as the taco incident, when Randy Newberg and crew came down for the first Arizona deer hunt camp. And Randy was in charge of buying groceries. He showed up with a few packets of McCormick's taco seasoning. I don't want to yuck anyone's yum. If you love McCormick's, by all means, that's great. But Hank Shaw and I were unloading the groceries, and we found that McCormick's, and it was we weren't sure what to do with it. Of course, we were deep in southern Arizona, really close to the Mexican border, and we felt like, man, we need to teach Randy a lesson down here first thing to educate him on tacos. And so we took those seasoning packets and right out to the fire and burned him right in front of him as he watched. And, told him that we don't do that stuff down here. We had to preserve the integrity of Arizona tacos. And so, from that moment on, I think Randy started to get an education on what it meant to have tacos and using game meat. He wanted to know what kind of tacos we made that day. And I just called them the Aravaca tacos, 'cause it was based on, some of the ingredients that we had locally around there, and, some preparation methods that are very, ubiquitous, here in southern Arizona. So to really broach this subject, you guys know me, like this wasn't going to be an ordinary discussion if I was going to tackle it. And so I searched the world over and I found America's first taco professor. Yes, everyone, there is a professor of tacos, where you can learn and eat tacos and develop your academic prowess regarding that. But he teaches a taco literacy course at St. John's University in New York. And before you guys jump on the Pace Picante bandwagon of New York City, get a rope. The irony and pun of that is not lost on me at this moment. But I'd like to introduce and welcome Dr. Stephen Alvarez.
Hello, thank you. Yes, I believe that was the Pace Picante advertisement. I remember that one growing up. And
yeah,
I'm from Arizona. So when I always thought about New York City, I was like, my first impression too, like, oh, they're not going to have very good salsa over there. But then it turned out to be, well, maybe we'll go into that story too. But the Mexican food over here turned out to be way better than I was expecting. So the stereotypes were there. And that just goes to say how Mexican food is basically spread everywhere. Yeah. And really transformed by where it goes, by also the people it impacts, and then the food and ingredients that are available. So I hope I can talk a little bit about Wild Game. I grew up, in Safford. So I grew up having friends, venison was pretty regular, javelina, quail, stuff like that. And then recently I had a friend here in New York that made venison barbacoa. The underground slow cook stuff in an agave leaf. Yeah. Really delicious. So that's, I think the McCormick stuff, I don't know what to say about that. I think McCormick recently just created a taco ambassador as a paid position. So they're in the game as well.
Well, they did. No one is sure. Like, we haven't heard who actually got that position.
It was, I don't remember her name, but she's a chef, but she has like an online cooking show, and I think that's what they were really looking for, to do like an online cooking show to use their ingredients basically,
right?
So anyway, it's, well, how would I put it, McCormick is one company that's capitalized on Mexican food. There's a number of them, but usually in this kind of case it's to reproduce the kind of food in an efficient and quick way,
right?
And really I guess the only thing you can kind of pour it on is probably ground beef. I'm thinking of like Hamburger Helper. It's like, the base of which you can put anything on to hopefully give it some kind of additional flavor. But I couldn't imagine putting it on any kind of game. I mean, that would be, that would be such a waste. So then I was thinking, well, if you burned it, maybe it smelled good. Maybe it smelled like incense or something.
I could appreciate that. Having that, those packets burn over, hot mesquite, here in Southern Arizona was kind of an interesting aroma.
I mean, even there, being around mesquite and smelling that and already knowing that that smoke's going to give a particular flavor that's local, that's really a tradition of like a Sonoran style Mexican food as well. Cooking with mesquite is really important, but then, really cool. So I'm glad you, it was a learning moment. So there was some taco literacy happening with y'all on your
too, see. Well, Dr. Alvarez, explain to the listeners what taco literacy is in terms of this course and that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's easier enough to know what a taco is.
Sorry, sure.
Yeah, I think that is right.
We can start there.
But then I have to go turn to literacy, I think, because I think you start – because literally taco is describing literacy in the name of the course. So my background is I'm a literacy scholar, and my research and the books I write have been about traditionally more Mexican, but also Latin American and Latinx migration to different places, Kentucky, New York City, and how people learn to be bilingual. Sometimes, unfortunately, having to repress Spanish for social circumstances for various reasons, politically, but also sometimes socially as well. But just the way different people negotiate using language, we're never thinking about people being lacking any kind of intelligence, or never even thinking about people lacking anything. That happens a lot for students of color, unfortunately. We're sort of, and generally, I think for education, it can be said that there's a model of education that thinks of students as empty vessels and that they're supposed to be poured in with like reading and writing. There's another way of looking at literacy, which is moving away from literacy as something people have or don't have, but as something people use. So literacy is a practice. And in this way, we get rid of people, students being full or empty and just coming to understand. Students come and they bring their own skills to a classroom. And they may be not necessarily those that line up with the standards of the school, but there might be other kind of practices that have to do with like practices around the home. Could be, for example, cooking, gardening, hunting, for example, things that have to do more of a day-to-day basis, but are still grounded in language. And so anyway, the research I was doing was always thinking literacy in this way. Literacy is a practice, and also how literacy gives dignity to people's lives. Well, I should have known, because when I was doing all this research with people, families were always bringing me food. And they were doing it mostly because I was like a starving graduate student. It was also because I was helping kids with their homework. And a lot of these families, some of them were from Mexico and the parents had maybe, middle school education. And I was helping the kids with the homework, and the food was their way of saying thank you, because we see you see our kid and we see you too, and here is this food, and we made this food, and this food is care. Well, you know, I'm Mexican too, Mexican American. And I realized like this was the way that my grandma used to show care for me because she couldn't speak English very well. And I grew up English dominant. And I always knew for a long time that was like when people give you food and you know they made it, there was a kind of bond that said like, I'm thinking about you, especially if it tastes good. Because yeah. If they're making that food, it tastes bad. That might be a reason too. But anyway, so coming all back to this, you know, later on, I started doing more research and got into food studies. And then I started seeing like these intersections of literacy and the ways people think about food are really interesting because for example, some of these same women that was, you know, helping their kids with homework, and this was like, you know, middle school English homework and so on, they had these incredibly complex recipes for moles that they had brought from Puebla, from where they live in central Mexico, and all these really delicious recipes and other things that they had developed that were really, really complex and intricate. But that wasn't going to be something that was necessarily measured on a standardized test. Right. So then I started to realize, well, there's ways we can think about food ways and also literacy to link Mexican food back to Mexican people, because the food is part of a kind of cultural expression in the same way I think literature is too. And so for me, it became a really cool way for me to kind of bring it all back together. So it's literacy, but then I had to really, you know, kind of come up with a way to move it into literacy. And I was like, well, the taco kind of does it all, because you can read all these layers of history and most importantly, bring it back to people and people's ways of language to the taco. So it was kind of a long sort of circle, but it always came back for me. I think, you know, myself being first generation college student and going on to be a first generation PhD, had pretty humble background. My mom and dad were janitors growing up. I used to go clean offices with them when I was a little guy. And I remember thinking like, you know, it was pretty rough, but we always had enough to eat. It was always beans and tortillas, don't get me wrong. But it was something that got me. Even when I went to college, my mom was sending me like freezer bags of beans, like sure. Tortillas. In fact, I just got a bag of 6 dozen tortillas the other day from Mi Casa Tortillas that she sent over here. You know, so that stuff has always been impactful for me, but also it got me to realize that sometimes, especially these days, and historically too, I think the tension between being neighbors, United States and Mexico, has its highs and lows, but there's a place where we can always sort of meet and agree to see eye to eye. It's like, well, we love food. And even Americans are like, well, we like your food a lot. And Mexicans are really proud of our food. So that was also a way for me to think about, well, what's a way that we can have a humanizing stance and at least have some of these conversations that might move beyond food, but at least we can have a taco together to start.
Right. Yeah. No, and that's precisely, I think, why, I was excited to get in touch with you and have this discussion today, because sure. I think you were the perfect person to relay some of those things to a lot of the audience members. I mean, like I said, sometimes, I mean, you don't have to have a deep thought about a taco, but there's a lot of depth in every taco when you kind of dig into it. And surprisingly, tacos are starting to become that universal thing that like I said, I mean, it's rivaling the hamburger at this point in America, where in popularity and use and certainly in wild game cooking. I know a lot of friends and folks. I'm just trying to figure out where to start kind of unpacking this topic, because there's so many different layers and levels. So like, I guess let's start with the taco, because I think you and I will get into a discussion maybe a little bit later about flour tortillas, because I think that's important as well. Sure. But really the taco itself, I guess, you know, starts with the tortilla in general, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, well, I would put it this way, that in the same way that folks who enjoy having a wild game and I don't know, put it this way, it's the vessel that brings the wild game to your mouth, that you can also eat the vessel. You can't go wrong. It's flatbread, but it's a corn-based flatbread. Well, the corn tortilla, but sure. Then there's a flour tortilla too. So to really start thinking about, to begin a taco, how to read a taco, I guess, the very first, and we can start the tortilla, you know, talk now. That one even goes on to a whole other level of race and colonialism and stuff too, because that's another way to read the taco. But actually, maybe to preface that, what you said before is like, yeah, you know, it's just a taco. yeah, you know, cool. It's a taco. Yeah. Taco Tuesday. Pretty cool. You can go to different places now and get them like on the, sports bar menu. Quesadilla was always kind of already there too. Burritos or wraps. But tacos are ubiquitous. Burgers too, as you said before. But burgers, like the taco, that was brought by immigrants. So that was brought by the Germans as well, the hot dog. And then it becomes American food. And the taco, a little bit more complicated, I guess, because I guess maybe, you know, to kind of break it down with some of the listeners here, if I say taco and you're imagining the hard shell emoji, the taco, that taco, that is a taco. It's true. That's the American taco, the U.S. taco, probably the one that's mass produced and most popularized by Taco Bell, for sure. What we'd call the shell is actually a tortilla, though. It's a tortilla fried into a U shell, and that would be a corn tortilla. Now, that is actually modeled after a taco dorado, which is a golden taco, which is basically a corn tortilla fried, but golden. And that would be a taco dorado that you'd find mostly, usually northern, northern Mexico, but it's something that, you know, Glenn Bell popularized and copied and also mass produced. Right, that's one thing. The listeners are also probably gone to places where you order tacos and sometimes it comes with only either cilantro and onions. Yeah. You know, no cheddar cheese, right. no diced onions. That's cool. Maybe cabbage, and maybe sometimes two corn tortillas stacked. But those are going to be some of the more, you know, quote unquote traditional tacos. People might even call those street tacos, but the tacos that come from more recent migrations or more closely identify with tacos you might get in Mexico. And so anyway, other tacos might be on a flour tortilla, what folks call a soft taco.
Yeah.
So the hard and soft taco, those are much the U.S. tacos. So there's U.S. tacos, there's Mexican tacos, and just like anywhere, you can imagine the U.S. where there's regional different kind of foods, where like biscuits are more popular than cornbread in particular places, and people are having fights one or the other, even though I think you can have both. In Mexico too, there are places where corn tortillas are more part culturally than flour tortillas, and it also is somewhat of a division this kind of way. Again, I think you can have both. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But anyway, so start off with the tortilla. When you read a taco, is it a corn tortilla? Is it a flour tortilla? You can even look at the kind of corn itself to even think about, is this a kind of GMO corn, or is this fair trade corn? Is this the kind of corn that is sort of was this tortilla made from ground corn, or was it made from this sort of masa flour, instant flour? You just add water. Is there two tortillas, or is there one tortilla? Because two tortillas signifies it comes from other place in Mexico. Excuse me. So that's just at the tortilla level. Even how to make a tortilla in the process, to know what that is. It's a whole thing in terms of like the transformation of corn into hominy. Is a process called nixtamalization. So this is an ancient, I guess it goes back to Aztec because the word is Aztec, but I think it goes back to predates the Maya folks, in fact. But anyway, these are sort of contributions that are Mesoamerican that go into just be able to make the tortilla. And then what you put in the tortilla, well, that's kind of up to you. But I would say that going back before the Spaniards arrived, because when the Spaniards arrived, they also brought beef, cheese, chickens. Goats as well, which ravaged the landscape. So some of the traditional game I think folks were eating back then were turkey. Turkey was pretty prevalent. I believe also there were some certain kind of dogs that were also brought up for kind of consumption, something like a chihuahua sort of kind of dog. And then I think, of course, like a lot of salamanders and fish and things like that. But later on, when the Spaniards came, they let goats just kind of run rampant, and then that became where goat became later on a staple, and especially parts of Jalisco and so on for soups like birria and things.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I'm kind of rambling here, but part of this is like, you know, when I first started getting into this stuff, I had no idea there's such tremendous food history or food scholarship. I mean, you take your pick. It's so interesting. So I used to teach in Kentucky, and I would ask students about some of the local dishes because some students would be from Ohio. And there's this like spaghetti chili.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And there's other kind of German food ways that are very local. And students would speak about it with pride, especially if it's where they're from. And when I asked them the history, once they started digging through the history is when they started getting really interested. And so, you know, I would encourage all your listeners too. It's a cool thing to kind of dig yourself into, and you'll surprisingly find a lot more scholarship that'll also give you a lot more, I think a lot more joy. When you eat the food, the more you know about it, it kind of gives you a different kind of satisfaction and appreciation for the history, and also for really what's powering your body. I mean, it's sort of ironic not to think so little about something that becomes so ubiquitous about of who we are and how we power our body. And that just goes in general for all food.
Yeah. I think, you know, evolutionarily, in terms of humankind's development and you know how we evolved with eating cooked food. I mean, we're the only species on the planet that eats cooked food. I was reading something at one point where they said, you know, the goal was, okay, we had fire, we could cook food, and then it was, you know, starting to transform things into like a pot or a bowl, something to cook in. You know, that was kind of a next big step. But then the idea of utensils, you know, a tool that's specifically used for either cooking or eating, in doing that. And the tortilla basically was kind of a stab at an edible spoon, I guess, sure. in some ways. I don't know exactly when they pin it down, but they think that the tortilla, the original maize tortillas and stuff were probably around 1000 BC or possibly even earlier. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, well, I want to say that corn was being cultivated. Oh, man. I remember checking my numbers right, but I think it started around 3000 BC. And I could be wrong about that, but definitely it's hard to say because I feel like just because corn was so ubiquitous, I mean, you're right. I think it was a tool, no doubt about it. It was sustenance too. And it was just like all the different ways that they were finding to cook it and to preserve food. So I guess maybe traditionally Mesoamerica, there was like the tortilla is one of the base foods. It all comes from masa, basically corn masa. And whether it's pounded flat and then cooked over an open flame, or whether if it's wrapped in either corn husk or a banana leaf or plantain leaf, excuse me, and then steamed as a tamal. These were sort of like the two kind of vehicles that were really built empires. I mean, built civilizations. It was able to have food that was grown, but also so people could eat to be able to build these gigantic architectural structures and so on. And so it's really pretty fantastic. I didn't think about the part about the food and, you know, and utensils, but it makes a lot of sense. Maybe the fire had something to do with, you know, trying to preserve food. I think I had read some stuff about the history of salt. Salt, by the way, has a really fascinating, like, oh, incredible. But like part of it was thinking about how to preserve food. How to preserve in a one way, but also how to increase flavor. But then how that, I think maybe the preservation got into like our way of just desiring the food as well, maybe even more than the food, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, I never really thought about just like, I don't know. There is a research paper for somebody to, I'm going to ask one of my students, somebody please research the history of the spoon. I want to know, like, or the fork, chopsticks. I imagine there's got to be some people because, you know, and chopsticks as well, like they vary by region as well.
And, yeah.
So like, I imagine there's probably some really fascinating history stuff with that. And then I'm thinking, yeah, you know, way back when, historically, I believe I don't think Mexican folks really had like forks or really utensils like in the way we would think of them today. I mean, a lot of bowls and stuff like that was used for mixing, but you know, I'm not really sure about utensils. And it makes a lot of sense that the tortilla really was used for everything. Yeah. And I think of it more the way it was used like was like some of the Ethiopian cuisine. If you ever have that sort of like ripped off and you just kind of grab stuff. Certainly when I grew up, that's the way like my father made breakfast. Actually, my mom always gave me like fork, like a proper human being. My dad just gave me tortillas. So anyway.
Well, so let's actually jump into the flour tortilla. Cause I know there is like a lot of misconceptions and debates about the flour tortilla. As though it was some kind of, you know, American device or invention that was in place of that, but it actually wasn't. It actually came with the Spanish when they came to Mexico, correct?
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, I mean, I'll put it this way. Yeah, it's that maybe the Spanish kind of set the model and then the Americans kind of capitalized it like as a neo-colonial model. But to put it in perspective, I guess first off, when the Spaniards came, the tortilla is actually called laxcali. That's what the Nahuatl word was, but the Spaniards couldn't pronounce it. But to them, it sounded like tortilla. So if you ever go to Spain and you get a tortilla, you're not going to get a tortilla. You're going to get like a quiche. So That's one thing. So they called it, you know, they called it their own name and became a tortilla. So basically it was just the corn flatbread, you know, that was nixtamalized corn and was pounded into flat discs that was cooked over an open flame. All right. Well, when the Spaniards came, it was the first time a European had encountered corn. I mean, certainly this kind of corn kind of bread. And so different kind of theorists look at this way that the through empire, it was one thing for the Spaniards to try to eliminate corn to build new markets for wheat. To try to eradicate corn, it was also essential to the indigenous cosmovision, really. From everything to the farming to the constellations of the stars and how they built their architecture was built on basically the calendar for corn. They considered themselves people of corn. And so anyway, the idea was that if they eradicated corn and they would use wheat, and they would build a new market to be able to sell wheat and also grow wheat. To eradicate all the corn, you make grow large monocrops or plantations of wheat. So this was the European mindset. Tried to eradicate corn, and also the way was thinking that, well, we are superior to you, and the reason why we're so much better is because we eat corn. So therefore, be like us, get rid of your corn so you can be more like your conquerors. The ideology assumes this anyway. Well, at any rate, can't kill corn. People love corn. Corn is just, it was also like people weren't going to give up corn that easy, and it was always going to be a fight. So historically in Mexico, and it goes back, I think it's, you know, around a colonial period, you know, things start to change a little bit, but it was the idea that eating flour tortillas was associated with northern Mexico. So the northern frontier states where the border is roughly around these days today. So people in the northern states are more likely to eat flour tortillas. And that also happened because of where wheat was growing in Mexico. And there was also less concentrated indigenous settlements there. And so anyway, and flour tortillas ended up being something that just were able to last a little bit longer in the frontier states. Corn tortillas remained pretty strong in the South. So it was sort of like this, this racial divide between so-called like white or European descended Spanish blood who would eat, or mestizos who would eat flour tortillas in preference to corn tortillas. I think it was most folks were having both, to be quite honest. People were having both. There was, you know, but more likely that if folks who were having flour tortillas are probably more likely to have corn because sometimes they're really hard to find in southern Mexico. Well, you know, fast forward a little bit further. Flour tortillas, because of the border, a little bit more prevalent, especially like in Sonora and those kind of places in Arizona. But, you know, go even further, it's like around the 1980s, NASA had tortillas in the space shuttle. One with the astronaut crew, partly because bread was getting stuck in the vents, stuff like that. So they were making like breakfast burritos in space. And then eventually, I believe these are the tortillas that were the ones that Taco Bell started selling because the shelf life lasted for who knows how long. So put it this way, the flour tortilla was already kind of modeled for some folks as a model of European imperialism, but it also became mixed because it was a flour. It was initially used for bread, but then became adapted to the flatbread kind of style. So it has elements of both. It has kind of the disc and also the technique that was indigenous, but with a different kind of material. But so it's something of the new world, really. Yeah. But it didn't really, you know, it catches on these days where we call it more for wraps. I mean, it's a tortilla. Come on now. But anyway, it is ubiquitous in this kind of way. And so, you know, later on in Mexico too, there was a migration of Lebanese people, turn of the 20th century, people who were Syrians as well, and Iraqi people who were Armenians too, people who were part of a genocide among Turkish and German folks. So a lot of folks from Lebanon went to a place called Puebla, and they brought shawarma, the big shawarma spits, right? Yeah. And so they also brought their bread, which was kind of like a pita bread. But in Mexico, they didn't understand it as pita bread. They called it pan árabe or Arab bread. Yeah. Right? So they had the pan árabe, and then they started seeing like it sliced off into their bread. And they're like, oh, that looks like that's a taco árabe. We want one of those Arab tacos. So later on, these became the kind of the grandfather of the taco al pastor.
Right.
So, you know, it's really interesting where the tradition, because in the same way that immigrants come to the United States and they rejuvenate the cuisine and they bring new things that change over time to the immigrants who are already established here, the same thing happens in Mexico. So Mexican food is constantly evolving with new migrants. These days, a lot of Haitian folks who are in Mexico, Central Americans more so than ever. And that's changing the cuisine as well. And then, and that in turn will change the cuisine when more folks from Mexico come to the United States here.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And for me, like, one of the stories that I had heard was actually one of the slaves of the conquistadors. It was kind of this neat story that one of the slaves, he brought, some kind of heritage grain. We don't know exactly where from. And they were much further south, in Mexico at the time. But, somehow, you know, it was kind of bringing a piece of him with him to, you know, the new world. And, somehow some of those seeds ended up with Father Kino. And that was the transition of how, it got into Sonora and created what we call the heritage grain Sonoran white wheat, which is used throughout Sonora and, you know, it's kind of seen a resurgence here in Arizona, that develops our style of flour tortillas because, you know, for anyone out there, I think, you know, the biggest thing kind of stepping back for a minute, I have talked to folks who say, well, oh, I don't like Mexican food. And I'm like, I don't understand that statement. For one, because, you know, they're kind of encapsulating everything into one segment. And, you know, trying to explain to someone, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but if you went just in the United States to California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, you would find four distinctly different cuisines, you know, typified by various different aspects of the culture, but then also, you know, getting into Mexico, I've heard everything in Mexico from that there are seven distinct cuisines, 12, 14, you know, but Arizona and New Mexico are right side by side next door to each other. And our foods couldn't be any more different. Our tortillas are very different. They use a flour tortilla it's quite a bit thicker and puffier. Ours is characterized, you know, very similarly by Sonora as well, that it's very thin, elastic and pliable, like you were talking about, Mi Casa Tortilleria out there in Safford. I've been there many times. And so when Randy comes down, he's not in charge of bringing tortillas to hunt camp. So that's kind of the one saving grace I think I have, but, kind of let's, you know, look at that as well, you know, how those different, kind of cultural areas and geopolitical boundaries really do define some different, you know, ideas in the taco.
Sure. I mean, you're right to point out, well, that's not, you know, on the borderlands, of course. And, I think it must've been a few years ago, my friend Gustavo Arellano wrote a really good book called Taco USA. Mm-hmm. I recommend for everybody. It goes into a lot of this history of, every chapter is different, portion of Mexican food. So going to like the history of the margarita, the history of the numbered plate, where you order plate by the number, difference between burritos from NorCal and SoCal and so on. But he edited a collection online on Eater, which you can find online, called United States of Mexican Food. And it goes into a lot of different kind of regional varieties of Mexican food. So these tater tot burritos that happen in the Midwest, the kind of tacos that are in Kansas City covered with Parmesan cheese. So you can read up a little bit on these kind of variations for, you know, for your listeners who are curious and learn a little bit more about the diversity of Mexican food. But yeah, you're right. You know, if you were to take a trip on the I-10, you can really find some. I would even keep going further, because I think you're going to find even more cool Mexican food the further you get into the south and going towards Georgia as well. But certainly the places where they've been, you know, folks have been there the longest, where it used to be Mexico, those four states you mentioned. You're right. Looking at the tortilla in those four places, it's kind of interesting, because I always think of Texas having these really hearty, thick tortillas. And that's also because there's a lot of these stew, like these guisado tacos. So they got to be pretty hefty to hold a lot of that stuff. And then New Mexico, they get a little bit thinner. And in Arizona, they get pretty thin. And in California is kind of like, Southern California's got a little bit of everything. So it's like, it has a lot of Sonoran influence, but it has just a lot of everything, which is kind of beautiful, which I love for all those reasons. But also more importantly, like the Tijuana influence with seafood and beautiful, all that great stuff. But you're right. You know, I think...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The best way I can put it is like, for folks who haven't been there, maybe the idea about Mexican food that might be popularized is thinking about fast food on one hand, or Tex-Mex, which is one genre of Mexican food, and one genre that sometimes folks get upset about. I respect it for what it is. I know what I'm getting myself into with Tex-Mex. I grew up with that stuff too. I appreciate it. But I also don't think of it as the be-all and end-all of what Mexican food is. That's kind of one facet. And it's a very American – it's a very Texas thing. Yeah. And then New Mexico, I love to think about, like, especially with the green chilies, but also mutton and you know, the blue corn and some of the tradition. I think there has a little bit more of like ranching communities. But it has a lot, very much a Texas influence. Although northern New Mexico and southern New Mexico are very different, because El Paso and Las Cruces, that area is kind of unique too. Even Tucson and Phoenix, I think, have their kind of variety and difference as well. But yeah, you're right. You know, and part of this is, I guess, maybe pointing to a larger question, is the kind of regionalism that happens. So there's a regionalism that happens in Mexico, and then there's a regionalism that happens with the migration in the United States. So that in the same way that there's a kind of taco that is a version of Michoacan, which is the Mexican state, or a kind of taco in Puebla or Oaxaca or Yucatan, and they all have their kind of signature tacos because every state is really proud of their food. And it's really big for tourism to promote how they're unique from every other state. Not unlike what we do too, I guess. Once folks migrate to the United States, wherever they come from, they might bring that tradition from wherever they're from and then adapt to whatever ingredients are available, what things are new there. And so this is really beautiful now, because historically those places we mentioned were, you know, historically have been close to the United States since they became nations ostensibly, or since there was the wars in the mid-19th century. The places where there's more recent Mexican migration is where we're seeing some really interesting, cool adaptations and changes. So, you know, there is in New York City here, as I mentioned before, a lot more folks coming from Puebla and Oaxaca. And this is meaning things like really cool al pastor pizza, New York slices of al pastor on, which is really great. Things change with New York, but then likewise, there's a lot more pizza in Puebla for folks who go back. There's like New York style pizza there too. And so things kind of have this kind of synergy. And what I love about this though is that unfortunately we mentioned before about the Pace Picante commercial about New York City. What do you know about Mexican food? Well, there are a lot of Mexican folks here. So yeah, you can't, before there weren't as many. So yeah, you wouldn't expect folks to know about Mexican food, but there's Mexican folks here who are like doing really cool stuff in terms of chefs, working in some of the high-end restaurants, most of the high-end restaurants, in fact. And so learning different kind of techniques, which they also apply to some of the techniques that are like ancestral. And also thinking about, you know, where they come from in terms of many of the folks have, if not one to two, maybe even three generations of roots, where they're not far that removed from the land, from where their family used to work. And so that's a different kind of respect for what's the potential. And then maybe sometimes what we lose because of the kind of farming and food industry, you know, stuff we have to deal with in this country, which we get a lot of good prices on stuff, but sometimes the quality of food is not what we can, we should be desiring or even demanding.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think is key to a lot of the listeners who, you know, especially, you know, you hunt, you cook your own game. I just want to point out that likely the taco introduced all of you to not only adding words to your lexicon. I mean, we're talking about cooking meat, but it's also given you kind of some additional outlets for how you cook that meat. In addition to those lexiconal words, carnitas, barbacoa, chorizo. Chorizo is becoming much more ubiquitous in wild game preparation, you know, for those folks doing it at home. Learning about, you know, those traditions of how that was prepared and you know, the flavors and what kind of comes into that, I mean, really kind of expands your own abilities and your own knowledge and things like that. And so I think that's, to me, why I thought, you know, this is, the taco is really an important subject in terms of wild game. And, you know, some people may not see the connection right away, but as we've kind of gone into this renaissance of wild game, and of course that's regionally different across the country too. I mean, you know, certainly, you know, you hear talk about javelina and things like that down here. And so, you know, I start looking at Conchinita Pibil and El Pastor and all those things. I mean, there's such a grand variety that comes with, meats that are prepared for tacos. You know, that I think of has expanded, our culinary skills, here with wild game.
Cool. Now, that's really exciting to think about. I mean, as soon as you're saying like different kinds of chorizo, I'm like, wait, what? Yeah. Because I feel like more, how would I put it, higher end chefs are looking for different ways of like doing, well, I'll put it this way. For a long time, like duck carnitas was pretty big because they're like, all right, pork carnitas are good. One hand, though, there are a lot of people who can't eat pork. So that's also, we have to do different things for the menu, but the preparation was important. And then folks were doing different things. I mean, even folks were doing like, for Jewish folks, were having a lot more pastrami that they were mixing into like burritos and tacos and things like that. In the sense that, you know, I can see some really, maybe I think of like different ways you could do barbacoa, like you say, with javelina as a pibil or as a slow cooked, like, oh, I bet that would be amazing. And you know, part of this too, is I guess it's a different way of honoring the different sort of traditions that are techniques. But really, the techniques themselves are going to bring highlight to the flavor of the meat, because the meat's always a star, in addition to usually the chilies or the spices. And so that also would give a different dimension to the way I would imagine, like, moving away from McCormick. But, you know, like, you know, like, I'm just thinking about, like, some of the delicious red chili from New Mexico, what that would be on just about anything, really. It's so delicious. But it's slow cooked as well. As like a guisado. And then, of course, always for me, like, you know, with tortillas, I just can't, I mean, I don't know. Because tortillas are such a everyday thing. That's like, that's, I have bread. I always have tortillas. This is just how I operate. So I'm already thinking like, oh, this sounds delicious. But it also sounds what I think what higher end restaurants are moving towards too. So different kinds of meat, but still in this kind of tradition that's Mexican. And I say this mostly like in, you know, New York City. I think across the country there are 5 Michelin Mexican restaurants and 3 are in New York City. Yeah. And, you know, which surprising enough. And so these are higher end though. And these are like places where, you know, the taco is a little bit more expensive, but also sometimes there's the idea that Mexican food should be like cheap food. But there is some of these traditions that are like as relevant, I think, to French cooking, you know, go back even longer. And so the techniques are proven. They've been there for a long time. I think they add a different dimension to the preparation. So that's really cool. I hope I encourage all of y'all. So if someone of y'all does like the Wild Gang Mexican cookbook, well, that'll probably be pretty cool.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, like I said, it's creativity within Mexican cuisine is just unbelievable. You know, and your creativity, you're only limited by your imagination when it comes to tacos. Because as long as you have a tortilla, you know, suddenly anything can almost become a taco in an essence. And different preparations. I mean, I think one of my more recent kind of taco adventures was confit duck legs. And then using a fig chipotle sauce that I just kind of came up with on the fly and, you know, really working through those things. Tacos are just, they're amazing. I mean, who doesn't like tacos?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's well, you know, I think maybe sometimes it's what goes in the tacos, what folks really stress, but I really think, you know, if you get a really good tortilla, and I think maybe like this would be the difference for, you know, for your listeners to think about, like if you've ever had a really fresh tortilla, and I mean like not necessarily the ones you get them from the store and you heat them up, but like one kind of comes from a tortilla factory. And so that might be a word for folks to look up, or tortilleria is how we say it in Spanish. And that might give you like a different kind of set to look up on Google Maps. But getting fresh corn tortillas or fresh flour tortillas, it's just like getting fresh bread. And it's one of the best, one of my happiest experiences ever, like really growing up, was my mom was making flour tortillas and she would give them to me right off the stack with like the stick of butter, just like butter it up. But like, you know, I think having a good tortilla makes the difference. I mean, what you put inside is really important, but to know the quality of the tortilla is like really fundamental, and to have a good tortilla. And, you know, to be honest, you can get some pretty good local tortillas most places. I would definitely check, especially in the Southwest, of course. If you're limited, some folks might find yourself limited. I think Trader Joe's actually has some pretty good flour tortillas. Not bad. And Whole Foods too, actually, you know, of course.
Well, yeah. And if you're interested in making your own, you know, the Sonoran flour tortillas are by far the simplest in terms of the amount of ingredients. It's just a lot of elbow grease and you know, some love in there.
Well, to be truly Sonoran, you should be using manteca or lard.
Right.
You can use Crisco if you need to, but some folks would just use water. You know, you can do it that way too. But yeah, you know, if you're really into, I think that would be the ultimate fresh way. And to see the process of making tortillas too really gets you to appreciate how much the labor that goes into these. And historically, in Mexico, this was considered women's work, the work that was from the division of labor that women would do, that be invisible by men. It would just be stacks of tortillas that were just there. But women waking up early in the morning sometimes to prepare the corn, to soak it and grind it, and the flour a little bit different, I guess. But even in Mexico, when mills became mechanized, started transforming from women's work to men's work. Once they become mass produced and engineers started taking more of the sort of like the lead in making tortillas. So even in Mexico too, there is a really interesting politics of tortillas, mass produced tortillas. And then it becomes later on to make this kind of corn powder. So masa harina, corn flour, that became a whole other industry as well. To kind of make Mexicans wanted their tortillas, but to make them as efficient as possible. Because like you said, it's so laborious. But that also meant that now these days, most Mexicans buy their tortillas a lot of times at Walmart. Sometimes tortillas made in the United States, they're not very good. But you know, and some of the folks, you know, who sell tortillas who are Mexican folks who move to the United States, but also in Mexico, these are very wealthy people. There's tortilla conventions, there's tortilla magnets. They're also the same folks who will make chips. And so they don't just make tortillas, you know, they make all these other tortilla affiliated related products, tostada shells and so on. So it's tortillas are a thing. People love tortillas.
Yeah. Making your own. So this is one of the other, kind of things and let me ask your opinion, flour chips or corn chips?
Oh, you know, I love them both. It's kind of like the same thing with cornbread or biscuits. I'm like, I love them both. I have used them both. But, you know, I think flour chips I grew up with in Arizona and Safford. But then I went to other places. I realized they weren't as popular, to non-existent, really. And so those ones I usually associate with like Southern Arizona or like New Mexico. And they're really, for me, not as common in other places, you know. But they're usually, you know, give me some nostalgia because I can even think of the restaurant I used to go to where I used to get flour, you know, flour chips. So pretty cool.
Yeah. One of the other encouragements I would have for the listeners, you know, if they're starting to explore this area and think about it, is, you know, certainly the peppers, the variety and an array of peppers and heat levels and tastes and flavors that come along with that. I in an earlier podcast, I was visiting with my friend Jesse there in New Mexico and kind of gave away a little secret that, you know, the chili powder in my house is actually certified Chamayo red chili pepper from New Mexico, which I think, you know, has made kind of a big difference. But, you know, part of that comes through just the exploration. I mean, there are everything from, you know, not hot to super hot, and everything in between in several different ways. And with Amazon and stuff right now, I mean, you can order dried chilies, you know, of pretty much any variety, it seems like. And even, you know, maybe check your local areas and see if, you know, if you can't get it, you know, see if you can start growing it, you know, a little small greenhouse or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely having fresh jalapenos is a great thing if you want to like pickle them and just use them for, you know, for any kind of cooking. But why did I put this? Yeah, there's so many different chilies. Usually if you get a pretty good Mexican cookbook, there will be a part where they'll kind of describe different kind of chilies. So there's, you know, there's the fresh chilies and then there's the smoked chilies and the dried chilies. And I came to realize that the dried chilies were the place for me. And I was like, you know, and then combinations of different chilies too. In the same way moles will sometimes have, you know, 6, 7, 8 different kinds of chilies combined and, you know, make a really rich sauce. And so the sauces are really the secret, I think, but also different ways you could use them as, and grind them up for powder and paste and things like that too. You know, I guess maybe the best, I guess, well, I'll put it this way. Sometimes you might get some chilies and they might be mild, but sometimes there's always, you know, sometimes there's one. There's one that might be a little bit spicy. So you never know. But I would tell your listeners a couple things. One, surprisingly, maybe in Walmart in the quote unquote Hispanic aisle, take a look down there and the spices there, you'll see sometimes there'll be dried chilies in bags. And you can kind of look them over, smell them a little bit. Chipotles are, for example, the smoked dried jalapenos. And there's some other ones that are ancho chilies, and they're just, they're long and dark. You'll find all kinds of YouTube tutorials on how to work with them, how to soak them, and then how to blend them up and then use them to, as a base to cook with or to preserve or freeze or whatever. What's really cool, though, is once you start messing with them and cooking with them, you'll see like the darker ones have a different kind of texture and flavor and maybe a smoky flavor, and then which ones are spicier. I like to combine like different kind of reds and blacks. They just seem to kind of work really well with my kind of flavors for me. But yeah, the chilies become a star, and it really became a thing for me. I guess growing up, I was always kind of curious because sometimes it's carne con chile or chile con carne. And I was like, yeah, it should be chile con carne because I think the chili is sometimes a star, especially with like some of the stuff from like the Pueblo chilies or some of the New Mexico red chilies, the Hatch chili too. But I really love the red chilies from New Mexico. Those have been like, my mom sends me bags of those too, actually. So I love that stuff. But yeah, I would tell you, as an additional way of thinking about, you know, historically what the chili pepper has been across the globe. I mean, it's really defined cuisines. So, you know, I think some of the origins are somewhere from the Amazon, I believe. And then it just spreads, of course, all over you know, the Americas. And then, of course, with the Spaniards, it finds its way to like Sichuan food. And just, I don't know if anyone could imagine Indian food without peppers or some of the Chinese food without peppers or what that must have been like. Likewise, though, Italian food without tomatoes, because tomatoes came from Mesoamerica as well. And so anyway, this is, you know, the pepper itself, you know, changed food. I think earlier you were saying before about some folks, you were saying like maybe they would kind of block up and say, I don't like Mexican food. Yeah, spice. I would imagine maybe spice might be the reason why, you know, turns off a lot of folks. Unfortunately, you can build up a tolerance. but also it becomes a thing where I think it highlights something about the flavor of the meat. But also the meat creates a different kind of flavor for the chili peppers too. So they're worth experimenting with. And like I said, one more thing, besides going to checking your local aisle at Walmart, if there is a Hispanic grocery store, definitely go in there. Don't be afraid to stop in there. With my students when I was in Kentucky as well, taught in the University of Kentucky in Lexington, there is a barrio called Mexington, because you know who lives over there, close by where the horse farms are. And there are some pretty big Mexican grocery stores over there. And I had one student who wanted to do a study examining organic food at Whole Foods and also at this Mexican grocery store. He wanted to check out prices and quality of food and things. Well, anyway, you know, he asked me if it would be okay if he went to the Mexican grocery store. I'm like, well, why not? Like, well, will they let me in? I only speak English. I'm like, hey, man. People do that all the other time, but they do it in the reverse, you know, yeah. They want, you know, so anyway, but he went in there and I was like, especially bring money to like you even better, you buy stuff. But anyway, he was going through, he was like all these kind of products he never knew, you know, some of them were the different kind of peppers, I remember. Yeah. So, you know, checking out different kind of peppers, if you have any of these cool markets and also some of the really fresh ingredients as well. And for pretty good prices as well, some pretty good fresh ingredients too. And it's also a cool way to see some of the other stuff with like, once you start looking at chilies, the next thing you know is Mexican candy. Get ready for that one. Spicy candies too. So you just, once you get down that rabbit hole, well, then you know how we say it. It's like, well, the way I put it is, once we have you with your food, then you can't help but love us. Because once you love the Mexican people, you'll love the Mexican food even more.
Yeah, I can second that. I when I started kind of my journey into expanding my horizons in Mexican cuisine and culture. You know, here's this big 6'4" white guy walking into to the El Rancho market or carnicerias or whatever. And you know, I think for me, you know, learning a little Spanish certainly helps. I wasn't, after a while, I mean, I wasn't afraid of talking to the abuelos who were shopping to ask them which brand of this they preferred over another, you know, for their cooking and trying to understand that. And the cheeses, helping to understand the cheeses or you know, the certain meats and stuff that come out of Mexico. There's a lot there, you know, surprisingly.
You're right. I mean, part of it is too. It's like, you know, I can imagine the kind of delight some of the folks too have. Some folks come in there and be like, "You're asking me because I actually, you know, you need to ask me because I do know this stuff." Yeah. But also, it's like when you can turn to them because, like, I need your expertise because I know you know this stuff because this is, I'm in your place, right? And I know I'm coming to you, but also that you're there, and that says something about, like, you know. I put it the reverse. Like, there is, as this young man was pointing out, is it going to be okay if I go in this place, I don't speak Spanish? I'm like, yeah, fine. People are bilingual. You'll find somebody, especially if you bring money. They'll make sure you will get your help. But also think about all the folks who come to the United States and they may not speak English and they feel that they're not welcome when they go to the grocery store or that they can't turn and ask somebody or they feel ashamed about talking to somebody or that if they don't speak English, that they would have to be ashamed. Or even try to hide that or disguise it because people might tell them to go back to where they come from or something. So to be in that position, I think, is humbling on one hand, but also humbling, and hopefully it gives us a better understanding of that thing that connects us. That if, you know, even if there is a language barrier and you're still sort of miming the words about, like, this chili good, spicy, hot, and you're getting some kind of recognition, you see somebody eye to eye, you can talk about food. That's a good place for us to start rather than having, like, these Twitter debates about, like, telling people to go back to where they come from and things like that. You know, if we can have those kind of human experiences, I think that, you know, brings us – it celebrates what brings us together rather than what divides us.
Yeah. And as kind of a side note, I was in Spain back in 2019, the year before the pandemic, and I had to catch a cab somewhere. Granted, my Spanish is not that great, but, you know, I know enough to get by and the cab drivers could immediately peg me, you know, as having a Mexican accent, even though I was being an American, you know. Getting through there, and they were like, yeah, don't worry, my English is bad too. So, like, because it wasn't the Castilian Spanish, you know. But I did get to experience the Spanish tortilla as a tapas dish there, which is not anything like a tortilla here in the States or in Mexico. So it is very much like a quiche. It was enjoyable to see and taste just kind of that difference of, you know, language and result.
Hey, it can be appreciated also. Spanish, you know, they got the good cheese, they got some good wine. They did a lot, you know, for Mexican food. It's kind of especially like in northern Mexican food, where, like, some of the tamales will have, like, olives and raisins, and that's, like, usually a hallmark of Spanish foodways and you know, California kind of style food. And so, actually, maybe for your listeners too, another way to think about this is, wherever you are, the different kind of, you know, for people come from Mexico and also United States, tamales will vary as well, and what's inside tamales. So that's another food to kind of compare with tacos. And who knows, maybe trying out with some game. I don't know. The tamale is another potential vessel y'all might try to challenge yourselves with.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, thankfully, I think I'm fortunate being here in the Southwest when it's tamale season, because as a way of additional income, a lot of families will produce a lot of tamales and sell them on the side of the road or, you know, at the gas station. And it's actually how some friends of mine, he found an old grandmother who, boy, she was, you know, her tamales were outstanding, and he worked with her to actually pay her, brought her a bear roast, And had her create tamales. So every year he tries to go out and get a black bear and brings her the big hind roast and has her make tamales for him and stuff. And so it's kind of it's an every year tradition now that he's kind of developed with her.
And I'd like to talk to that lady and see what she thinks about that. I was like, wow, have you ever worked with a bear before? See what she had to say. Wow. I put it this way. It's in good hands with hers because I think she would know what to do or she would figure out a way to work it out. But that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually kind of sounds like another way where, like, again, like building community, getting to know folks. And then, of course, like, I'm sure he gives her a piece of, you know, some bear to work with and keep on her own too. So that's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah. We've done that with, friends at work. You know, they're mother or grandmother, somebody's, you know, making tamales and stuff. And so I'll be like, hey, you know, can I trade you up and, you know, give you two elk roasts, you know, one for tamales and for me and one for you guys. And they're like, yeah, sure. So, but so we're within the taco verse, as it were, you know, I know there are like what are considered authentic tacos, you know, that really capture the moment and place, the traditions and everything that they come from. And then there's kind of, you know, strange thoughts about the redesigning or reinvention of tacos elsewhere. Do you see that as kind of a good thing or, you know,
I guess maybe what I generally in my classes, what we teach or what I teach to, we sort of try to move around the notion of authenticity, because sometimes it can be like a fruitless search to find out what is authentic or sort of the original.
Right.
I think that sometimes it's useful to be able to have like a history, maybe not to point to what the history was in the origin, but to be able to see things moving over time. And so to think about, you know, what is authentic, I think maybe, you know, Tex-Mex food might be an example. We can kind of look at this, like as some folks might say, well, Tex-Mex, I think Kennedy is kind of notorious for this, actually saying Tex-Mex is like this sort of bastardization of Mexican food that, you know, should be ashamed of itself as a cuisine. I mean, just some very sort of harsh words for Tex-Mex, but also holding up like Mexican food from Mexico, particularly from like indigenous villages, as being like the sort of the pinnacle of like what Mexican food can be in this kind of way. Well, all right. Well, that's sort of Tex-Mex is its own thing, but to kind of like, I don't know, trash Tex-Mex is also kind of like a way to kind of trash Texas Mexican people too. And so like the food and the people, I think, go together. And to put it this way, to try to find like a food that is authentic, I think Tex-Mex is authentic for what it is, for what it is, as like for what it's recognized. So, I mean, it's hard for me to say like, if I have a taco in Mexico, that would be an authentic Mexican taco, because it may not necessarily always taste good. I mean, more than likely, it's going to taste better, but it may not. But there are some really good tacos here, and it's hard to say, well, it's authentic. It has a lot in common with foods that's a lot would be common, I guess, rather to say it's authentic. So it's kind of a tough one for me. But I would say that, like, as the foods change over time, you can see certain things that are just very trendy. And you can see things that kind of won't last, or things that are trying to be, I don't know, try to be movements sometimes. For example, so New Mexico had its kind of moment for being like a kind of food, a New Mexican food. These days we can find it with like the remnants of like, I don't know, a fiesta salad that has like corn cob and blue chips. That was sort of like this New Mexico kind of California movement that happened for a little while. It was pretty trendy. Seemed like it was going to be the way to go, but it never really kind of caught on the way some other trends did. These days, I would say there is this birria taco.
Birria,
I'm sure you probably say. And this is like the one that's like gone all over the country now. All right. A lot of folks would be like, well, that's a really authentic taco. And other folks were like, what are you talking about? It's like an Instagram taco. Now, like birria itself is like a stew that goes back a long time. It's basically like a chili stew. Historically, it was either usually goat or lamb, but this is a version from beef. And this one comes from Tijuana, so Baja California Norte. And so it got really popular, this kind of style taco in California, because this guy set up a stand, birria tacos, And I guess on Instagram, they're doing their promotions, but it was like a really photogenic taco to see it dipped in the consomme. Yeah. And it just became like popular. So this Tijuana style birria that went to LA, went all over the country. So, I mean, it's everywhere. I was in Puerto Rico recently. It was there. It's New York. It's everywhere. And so this has been like kind of a recent trend, maybe the last few years. Some folks will be like, yeah, it's pretty authentic. It tastes pretty Mexican. It tastes pretty Mexican, I guess. Is it authentic to what birria is? Well, like, hard to say because it's changed over time, but it is what it is. It's its own thing, and I got to be able to appreciate it. But to know it's a little bit more like circular rather than just appeared gives a kind of a better appreciation for what it is too. So, you know, I guess maybe the – you know, other folks who are doing trendy stuff that might be like, I don't know. I see these really weird food videos where people are putting like shredded pieces of gold on tacos. I'm like, I don't think that's going to catch on. I don't know. But then there's others that, you know, they might catch on where they might be kind of cool. I'm thinking of like Southern California, the Kogi taco truck that was the Korean bulgogi inside a tortilla. So that became like a thing that's still pretty held on. I mean, Korean food and Mexican food hybrid, it makes a lot of sense. There's some really good spice and like fermented vegetables and stuff. Definitely barbecue traditions in northern Mexico as well. So, you know, you kind of have to sort of be on the lookout for these trends, but then realize too that I think for those that do make it and become a thing, there's plenty of bad ideas out there too.
Yeah. Well, I've noticed one of the things since you brought up birria is the additional trend to that has been birria ramen, and how that's really taken off. So
that's another thing that's kind of like this weird photogenic thing. But you know, it's people in Mexico City. A lot of food trends happen in Mexico City. So if any of your listeners are on Instagram checking out some of the food folks who are in Mexico City, you'll see all these kind of really interesting street foods. And just like anywhere, street foods are the kind of thing where you have to compete with other folks, sometimes going over the top. These kind of cups of soup have had their day in Mexico for a long time, but then they became like, wow, they're just – people are outdoing each other. I mean, they're like – they're pretty intense. And then, of course, like I think when folks saw what was going on with birria and social media and just presence of Mexican food on social media, especially for a lot of young entrepreneurs. So that's probably another place to explore. And then I imagine there's probably chefs who are doing wild game, have a pretty big Instagram presence, who are doing kind of cool stuff too. So that's like another realm where I feel like the popularity of what becomes trendy is out there and maybe helps like make some stuff catch on a little bit better. I can't really say, but it's definitely a place where I feel like some of the trends are beginning. And then it's certainly, you know, I live really close to one of the first birria trucks here in New York City. And that place still has lines down the block still. So that's pretty cool. I guess. And they're usually very young people too. So, and they're all on their phone. That's all I got to say. Yeah.
I will say that, you know, one of the things that I discovered in kind of my culinary journey is how close sometimes some of the Mexican recipes and techniques are honestly at a specific level, but at a fundamental level, sometimes only one or two ingredients off from Southeast Asian cuisine. And you know, some of those connections were, you know, obviously, you know, the peppers are different, Thai chili versus something from Mexico or whatnot, but, you know, and maybe fish sauce. And suddenly you can transform a dish one way or the other, you know, simply with the inclusion of a couple of ingredients and stuff. And to me, that's kind of been fascinating.
Yeah, I think, there's a few things there. One was that, like, there was the trade between, like, Spanish galleons in the Philippines that had a lot of different ingredients were going back and forth, and that was impacting the global food system altogether. And then on the, I guess, moving a little bit further, maybe even further back, these are, like, ancient cultures that have been, like, you know, making food for a long time, India as well. And so, like, you know, these are still living cultures where, like, the dishes they made were, like, ancient. And the kind of understanding for food goes way back, too. So not only that, but also the food, not just for flavor, but also for, like, medicinal purposes. Also sometimes traditional farming practices about what, you know, what to plant together, not to have, like, monocultural fields, but like biodiversity that was natural pesticides. And like in Mexico, they had this, I guess in the United States, they call it the Three Sisters. It's the milpa. So it was like squash, corn, and beans growing together symbiotically. And so, you know, that was also together like a central part of their diet. And like I said, their cosmovision. So their reverence for food is one thing about the mixture of flavors, but it was like stuff that had been passed on for generations. So, you know, the complexity of some of the salsas goes way, way back. And so much so that when, you know, the making of mole, like in places, can be considered something like a spiritual experience. Because sometimes they're cooking for 2 or 3 days, and the flavors, you know, putting people, well, how would I put it? When putting the food together, it's about the stories coming together, remembering ancestors. So, you know, think about a lot of the rituals that involve food and big feasts and preparation of feasts and the care that goes into the food. And that's not something that's unique to Mexican culture. I think that's something that's, you know, unique to humankind in general, really. But to have those kind of celebrations with like the complex food, some of the really, really old foodways traditions, I'm thinking of India and some of the Chinese foodways, and of course some of the Mesoamerican foodways. Yeah, you know, you can kind of, you really can taste the history.
Yeah, it's, and all of that in a simple as a taco wrapped in a tortilla, you know.
That's right.
Well, Dr. Alvarez, it's been great having you on. I super appreciate all your knowledge and information you've been able to share today. I think hopefully the listeners got as much out of this as I did. It's educating me as well, and you know, some things that I didn't know or was aware of, and you know, just kind of want to expand that culinary perspective. Cool. You know.
Great. Well, you know, if any of your listeners ever figure out like how to do some like bear tamales and you want to send me some, look me up. I want to check that out.
Absolutely. Well, if you ever make it back down here to Arizona, you know, maybe we should grab a taco.
Of course, yeah.
We can commiserate about the quality of good tortillas from around the state. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. All right.
Thanks again. I really appreciate it. Like I said, folks, this has been another topic that's been sitting on the back burner and brought forward to the front for at least a little while. Appreciate y'all listening. I hope you tune in again real soon. Thanks, folks.